Hey, Black and Published family, it's Nikisha. I want to say thank you for rocking with me these last few years. Over the course of these 5 seasons, I've shared with you the journeys of countless writers, including myself. I've told you about starting out as a self-published author and when my first nonfiction book came out in 2022. I have a new novel coming out in January entitled The 7 Daughters of Dupree. The story is a generational epic about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of 7 generations, told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860, and it's available for pre-order now, everywhere you get your books. I am beyond excited for this novel. It is my first Big 5 book, more on that later, and I'd like to make it a success, and I need your help to do that. If you can, please consider pre-ordering The 7 Daughters of Dupree today. Now let's get to the episode.
My career goal is to continue to tell these stories where Black women see themselves loved and getting that happily ever after. And so I take that responsibility very seriously.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Christina Forrest, author of The Love Lyric. It's the final installment of Christina's romance trilogy about 3 sisters who are named after flowers, a series she started while still working full-time in publishing and as an author with a few YA titles to her name.
If you are not in it and you don't see how these meetings happen and how all of these different things from when a book is acquired to when it gets out on a shelf, there can be a huge lack of transparency.
Christina's work on both sides of the aisle in the publishing industry gives her a unique advantage, even if she still has questions. The reason she's concerned about YA as a whole in publishing. Plus, the timeline she set for herself to achieve her dreams so her MFA wouldn't be a waste of money. And why she says the heroine in The Love Lyric deserved her happily ever after the most. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. Christina, when did you know that you were a writer?
I really enjoyed doing picture prompts when I was younger in school. But I think that it became clear to me that other people thought that I had a talent in writing when I took a creative writing class in college my sophomore year. And the people in my group really liked the story that I turned in. And my professor encouraged me to sign up for another creative writing class. And then I was like, oh, I guess people, you know, see something. They think that I should be doing this. And that was very encouraging for me. So I think that was the first time where I took something that was a hobby and received positive feedback from it and felt like a person who had the potential to be a writer.
When did it go from being just a hobby that you were good at to something that you wanted to pursue?
I think it probably was that moment. My senior year of high school, I took a creative writing class as an elective, and it was the first time they ever offered creative writing at my high school. And our English teacher taught the class, and she brought her dad in to do a school visit. And her dad was an author. He wrote middle grade and young adult novels. And he gave, you know, a presentation of his books. And then at the end of his presentation, he said, you know, my books have helped put, he was talking about our teacher, helped put her through college. And that was a light bulb moment for me, like, oh, this is a real thing. This is a real career where you make enough money where you can help put somebody through college. And that was actually the moment where I decided that I wanted to major in writing for college. So when I was doing my applications, I was looking for different English programs and writing programs and things like that. But it was that moment again in my sophomore year of college where my creative writing professor encouraged me to take more classes. And then the other creative writing professors encouraged me to keep going. And one of them told me that I should apply for a MFA program, which was helpful because I had no idea what I was going to do after college. But I was like, okay, I'll apply for some programs. And I always wanted to live in New York. I'm from New Jersey. So I would go to New York with my mom every summer. And I loved the idea of the being a writer in New York thing, you know. And I was a big fan of Sex and the City. I wanted to be like Carrie Bradshaw, but without all the big drama. And I got accepted into the musicals program. And then I moved to New York. And that tuition bill was not cheap. Had to take out a lot of grad plus loans to go there. And because it was so expensive, I became even more determined to get a book deal. Because otherwise, I felt like it would have been a waste of money and resources. Mm. Like, I needed to graduate and get that book deal because that's why I moved here.
So then you graduate from grad school with your MFA and your senior thesis. You're 23. Mm-hmm. Do you immediately get that book deal or what's happening, sis?
I graduated in May of 2016 and I took the month of June off because something that the New School does in your thesis semester, you're supposed to be working on your book. And they paired us with publishing professionals in the industry. And my thesis advisor was an editor who's also an author named Jill Santopolo. She has written across the board, some middle grade, some YA, but now she's primarily writing women's fiction. But she was pretty high up at Philomel, which is a young readers and Penguin Young Readers. And getting that chance to work with her was a very, very great experience because she was an editor. And the book that I was writing was a YA novel that took place over the summer. And so what we would do is I would write all of June, all the events that happened in June, and I would send it to her and she would edit it and give me notes. And then I would send her July and then August. And so I was able to work with her on a full-length novel. And when I was in grad school, I had hella jobs. And so it was very rigorous. And then I got lucky toward the end of my thesis semester. I got hired at Simon & Schuster full-time after an internship that I had. I was all enmeshed in publishing, but I kind of wanted a little bit of a break. So I took the whole month of June off from writing and I had started a couple projects and I had a few ideas and I was trying to decide which one seemed like the best book to try to get me an agent and to get published with. And I had my thesis idea. I had another idea that leaned a little bit more literary. And then I had a third idea, which was a little bit more commercial, more fun. And I was the most excited to write that one, which I feel like was a good indicator. And I also thought it was a good way to establish my overall vibe and branding. So then I started working on that. And I started that in July and it took me about 10 months to do the whole thing. And then I revised it with notes from some of my classmates from my grad school program. And then I got an agent. I want to say the whole process of querying and getting an agent took about a month. And then we went on submission in July.
And this is still 2016 or is this 2017?
Sorry, no, this is the next year. Yeah. So I started writing this book in July, so 2 months after I graduated. And then in May of 2017, I got an agent. And then July, I think we revised it together for like a month and a half. And then in July, we went out submission. And I was on submission for about 2 months. So I think it was like end of August when I got a book deal. So it took me after graduation, like a year and a couple months to get my first book deal.
And you were still working at Simon the whole time?
At a certain point, I moved over to Random House Children's Books. So I was at RCB when I got my book deal.
So you were fully enmeshed in publishing. You're writing and trying to get into publishing as an author.
Yeah.
What has that experience, or what did that experience do for you by showing you how the industry works from both sides of the aisle?
So it's definitely been very, very beneficial to know how the sausage is made. If you are not in it and you don't see how these meetings happen and how all of these different things from when a book is acquired to when it gets out on a shelf, there can be a huge lack of transparency. You know, that's why agents are so important because they're there to bridge that gap between what your publisher is or isn't telling you and what you do or don't know, because you don't know the things that you don't know. And so I think it's helped me navigate the publishing industry or my career because I know what questions to ask and what I don't need to worry about. I think that there can be a lot of things that as authors we can let ourselves get stressed about. And I think because I've been in the meetings where I know how different things happen, I know what to push on and what I don't need to push on, what's important and what maybe isn't that big of a deal, even though maybe sometimes people think it is.
Can you be more specific?
Yeah. Yeah. Something I've been thinking about very recently is that a conversation I saw online was talking about Goodreads ratings and whether or not authors should be worried about their Goodreads score and if that's going to keep them from getting future book deals or if it's going to tank their career right out the gate if they don't have a high score. And it's like, not really. What matters is sales. At the end of the day, in almost any given situation, what matters are your sales numbers. And so if you have a low Goodreads score, it can hurt your feelings. But if you have good sales numbers, that's all your publisher cares about, really, at the end of the day. So that's just one example. I'm trying to think of another one. But now, of course, that you asked me, I'm blanking.
Okay, so then I'm gonna do the work of the interviewer that I am, right? And I will just bring you the questions that I have as an author with the debut coming and being on Threads with all the anxiety in the world. The question about marketing and publicity, like you talked about what you need to push on and what you don't need to push on. In that kind of conversation, where do you fall?
So I guess what I think about a lot is my audience. And I think that across the board, unfortunately for Black authors, we just end up having to do a lot more work to push our publishers to make sure our books are getting to our core audiences. Because a lot of the time, the way that marketing plans are made, it's not necessarily copy and paste, but you have a book coming out this year and they'll take a marketing plan from a similar book, similar genre. And, you know, you make some changes here and there, but you're thinking about trying to get the same placement at certain outlets or things like that. But it's like, what works for this person might not work for this book. You need nuance. Mm-hmm. And so when I get my marketing and publicity plan, I'm reading over it and I'm saying, actually, my readers aren't here. We need to go here. Money. Again, it all comes down to sales and money. From my experience in publishing, I'm able to look at a marketing plan and tell how much money is going into it. Ultimately, that is what makes a huge difference. The books that you'll be like, I see this book everywhere. Where the hell did it come from? It came from money. It came from the publisher putting a lot of money behind it so that you keep seeing it over and over and over again to the point where you're like, wait a minute, where'd this come from? What is this about? You know, that thing that they say where you need to see a book 9 times or see something 9 times before you click the link or whatever. It's kind of true. And in terms of publicity, it's also, I think that something I've been thinking about a lot lately is in terms of tour stops or things like that. You can have a broad readership across the country, but trying to go to places where you know that, where you would hope that your readership will show up. So like Black-owned bookstores or cities where you know have like larger Black populations. That's just something that I've been thinking about a lot because my core readership is Black women. And so I'm always thinking about what more can I be doing to make sure that my core readership feels seen and that they feel marketed to. And I'm thinking that way because I'm Black and I write about Black people, but like my publishing team, sometimes these are different conversations that we have to have. And I've been very lucky that, you know, my publicist, my marketing manager, my editors, we are all on the same page about that nuance that is needed to try to push a book in the direction that it needs to go. And I do think that because I used to be the colleague of the people on my team, my YA editor said this to me before. She was just kind of like, when I have conversations with you, I know that you're asking necessary questions. And that's not to say that people ask unnecessary questions, but she was just kind of like, I know that you know the industry and the things that you're asking and pushing for are conversations that should be having or things that we should be thinking about and worrying about.
When you were getting your first deal and even your successive books and having an idea of how the industry works from working in it for so long, mm-hmm. how has your experience been as a Black author writing primarily toward Black audiences and making sure those readers know about your work.
Mm-hmm. So I honestly, my experience in adult versus YA has been night and day. And it is fascinating even to me. I think one of the biggest differences is that with my adult stuff, I have a direct line to my audience. If you follow me on Instagram, or if you are signed up for my newsletter, or if you follow me on TikTok, if I post something, hey, I have this thing, or I'm doing this thing, I'm going to be here, or, you know, here's a pre-order campaign, you're seeing it, and I'm talking to you directly, or I'm DMing you directly. You're telling me that you love the book, and I'm, you know, responding to say thank you. And I have a direct way to build community with my readership, because we're all in the same space. It's harder with YA because there are barriers between me and my audience. They're just gatekeepers. You know, there's the librarians, there are teachers, there are the booksellers who have to see the book, then get it into the hands of teens. And so because I don't have that direct line, it has been hard for me to figure out that mode of communication, especially because my YA books are considered commercial. So I'm not always the person who gets invited to do a bunch of school visits. I'm not winning Newbery's or Prince Honor Awards. You know, my books, they're commercial. They don't have the literary appeal or merit, I guess I should say. Whereas if you are in that arena of YA publishing, you're going on the school visits and things like that. And just a side note, critique sort of that, I think that YA romance, unfortunately, sometimes gets the short end of the stick in that way. I think that our books can be seen as more frivolous, when it's actually very, very important, in my opinion, for young readers to see examples of respectful and positive relationships at that age. So that's just like my aside.
I know that the industry, at least from my perspective, pigeonholes romance as genre fiction, and so not as serious as far as like a more literary novel. And so I guess from your experience, because you're writing adult romance, which we're here to talk about today, as well as YA, why does that pigeonholing exist, even though it's the genre fiction that makes the industry the most money?
Yes. I always say romance keeps the lights on at every single publisher. You know, I don't really know. I'm trying to figure it out with when it comes to YA romance. And I feel like what I love about Tia writing Audra and Bash is that it's sort of the tide that lifts all boats. I think sometimes it takes a bigger author coming in like that to help get readers to look for more books like that. Like someone could absolutely read Audra and Bash and be like, I really want to read more Black YA romance. Or for example, Love Radio by Ebony Liddell that came out a couple years ago, and she just had This Could Be Forever that came out a couple weeks ago. They could read those and then read Arielle's book. You know, so I think that is absolutely something that helps. But across the board, I have been just a little perplexed about what's going on with YA contemporary in general. Mm-hmm. There's some really, really fabulous books that have been publishing, and it seems like they're kind of falling through the cracks, which makes me really sad, just as someone who used to work in children's publishing. And so that's why I've just been so curious.
And it seems, at least to me, from my corner of the world and internet, that like audiences are hungry for those stories.
Yeah.
Like all the commotion that Forever just caused on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there are scores of books that meet that criteria, even though Forever is adapted from a Judy Blume novel from 1975. Yeah. It's still YA. Mm-hmm. And we know with the adaptation of the series that there's an audience hungry for Black YA romance, like what they just watched, right?
Yeah.
And even like the success, like last weekend was what, the Black Romance Book Festival? The inaugural Romance Book Festival. They've already announced they're doing a second one next year. And so I feel like there's always this tension between what the industry is doing and what audiences want. And as an author, how do you bridge that gap?
So I actually have a very clear answer for that. I was there. I was at the Black Romance Book Festival this weekend, and it was amazing. There were so many people there, and it was such a great opportunity to see so many readers in person, you know, because so much exists online. And what was interesting is I had this banner that had all of my adult romances, which I think people are a lot more familiar with. And then I have my YA books, and I have a YA coming out in October. And I was genuinely surprised by how many readers were telling me that they were excited to read it. And I was like, oh, like, y'all read YA? They're like, yeah. And I was like, wow, is this just great for me to literally be like a journalist or investigative journalist in the field asking these questions? Like, oh, you like reading YA? Like, oh, okay. Because I was unsure what the demand was there, but it was an amazing event.
What does it mean to you to see your readership hold you down and hold lots of Black authors down just in general in a way that sometimes the industry does not, even though it's the industry that's invested in them? Yeah. And technically this readership.
I mean, it means everything. It feels like sometimes we all are kind of persevering in spite, you know? And when we as authors, we are writing, you know, I hope that anybody can read my book and find some way to for it to be relatable. That's my ultimate hope, that no matter who you are, where you come from, you can read my books and find something relatable about them or something that touches you and that you can enjoy it. But as a Black woman, when I'm writing and I'm writing about these Black women made characters, whether they're 17 or 27, I am thinking about myself and my friends and other Black women. And that's just the career goal. My career goal is to continue to tell these stories where Black women see themselves loved and getting that happily ever after. And so I take that responsibility very seriously. And so when I meet readers who understand what it is that I'm trying to do, I feel like it creates this like unspoken bond between us. And I'm sure, you know, all other Black romance authors feel the same way, whether, you know, you're writing romantic comedies like me or you're writing contemporary romance or romantic suspense. We all, regardless of the tone of our novels or how we're telling these stories, we all have a common goal to write these stories about Black women falling in love and being loved. And I think it just ends up creating this very strong community, especially because like so many things in society try to say the opposite. That's why Forever is such a special show, because I can't even remember the last time I saw a YA TV show with two Black leads and it was about them and their families and the class differences between their families. You know, that's why they're so important, because we don't get them that often. And then when they come and they're good and they really speak to all various aspects of the Black experience, we all just like hold on to them so tightly.
And like listening to you talk about it now and seeing, you know, Tia and Kennedy Ryan on tour and just thinking like, you know, Black romance novels where Black women are loved well, it's like revolutionary work, considering the state of like the manosphere and toxic masculinity and all that has happened in the last few years. In that growth of like the podcast bros. So, and thinking about that for that frame of mind, and we're here to talk about your novel, The Love Lyric, today, which is the final novel in your series of those three sisters. Where did that idea to have those three sisters and their three stories start?
Okay, so taking it back to 2019, I conceived of the series at the same time.
Okay.
It was a couple months after my debut YA published in 2019. And I always knew that I wanted to be able to do YA romance and adult romance if I could, because I was a huge reader of adult romance. And all I had was that I wanted to write a book about three sisters and they would be named after flowers. And I was conceiving of this when I was at my grandmother's house visiting her. And she was always a big gardener and she had flowers all in her backyard, flowers all over her house. And I feel like I've been, you know, surrounded by flowers my whole life. And that was the idea that I had, just a series, three sisters, they're all named after flowers. And then I had to sit on it for 2 years because I was still working full time. I had other books that I was contracted to write and I didn't have time to work on it. And it wasn't until 2021, when pandemic made us all work from home, and I was no longer losing 2 hours of my day in my commute, but then I was still waking up early as hell anyway. And also, this one Memorial weekend, my husband always goes camping with his family, and I'm not a fan of that. So I was at our apartment by myself, and it was raining the entire time. And I just remember thinking to myself, I should try to work on this series. And, you know, you miss all the shots you don't take. Mm-hmm. The worst that it can happen is everybody says no. You know, like, who knows? I have this extra time. I'm just going to try to work on it. And so I would start writing by hand the emails between Lily and Nick in A Neighbor Fever when I was working on, because I would revise my third YA book in the morning. And if I had like an extra 20 minutes, I would just write the emails by hand. And then a few months later, I had all these handwritten things, and then I typed them up and, you know, edited them as I went. And then I wrote a couple chapters and started coming up, basically building my proposal package, because we sold The Neighbor Fever on proposal. And I shared it with my editor and one of my best friends from grad school, because I was like, is this trash? I can't tell. Because, you know, sometimes you're this close to the book, you have no perspective. And so I sent it to them. I was like, do you think this is something? Is there something here? And they were both like, yeah. You know, my agent was like, you know, write a little bit more and we can revise it and go on submission with it. And I was like, okay. And so that's what I did. And then it was the fastest submission experience I ever had. I was only on submission for 2 weeks. But when The Neighbor Fever sold to my publisher, Berkeley, and that was like a whirlwind.
So that was 2019 and mm-hmm. you sold the first one. It's obviously a series and you've wrapped it up with the love lyric. Can you read something from the love lyric so that we can talk about the book?
Yeah.
The Love Lyric by Christina Forrest is the final installment in the Green Sisters series. It's been years since Iris and Angel first met. Now, Angel is a bona fide R&B superstar, and Iris, a widowed single mother, is finally ready to open her heart again. But their careers and their family seem almost desperate to keep them apart. Here's Christina.
I'm going to read from chapter 2, and this is when Iris and Angel first see each other again. They haven't seen each other in like 3 years, and at this point, he is already very famous. Iris doubted that Angel remembered her. Their brief conversation at Violet's anti-wedding party 3 years ago had predated his rise to mega fame, and his life had drastically changed since then. Before, Iris hadn't heard much about Angel outside of the few times Violet had mentioned him. And Iris had certainly never heard any of his music. He'd also looked slightly different. No burgundy hair or nose ring, and no expensive clothes, as Violet hadn't yet worked her stylist magic on him. Now Iris couldn't turn on the radio without hearing at least one of Angel's songs. He was on television, starring in Adidas and Peloton commercials. He was on the cover of magazines, flexing his muscles, gazing at the camera. She'd even once seen an ad for his last album on the side of a New York City bus. His sound was like upbeat R&B. People obviously liked his music because he'd won a Grammy and consistently topped the Billboard charts. The Save Face Beauty team's intention had been to share the message that skincare should be a universal topic regardless of gender. Because Angel was the current man of the moment, he'd been Iris's first choice for the brand ambassadorship. Over the last few months, she had gotten to know the details of his face intimately as she pored over images from his Save Face Beauty photo shoots. She'd worked with the PR team to orchestrate a week-long meet-and-greet tour at several Refine stores across the country, where Angel would promote their new skincare line. Refine was one of the leading retailers of personal care and beauty products. The Refine customer demographic was made up of people aged 18 to 34, which was the same demographic of Angel's fan base. The tour was set to take place in a couple weeks, and Angel would be accompanied by Iris' colleague Paloma, the head of PR. Iris' hope was that Angel's involvement would help turn things around for the company. She peered around the tree trunk as Angel angled his face closer to his phone camera and grinned. Iris was still thrown by the woof-woof he had spoken into his phone a moment ago. Was he talking to a girlfriend, a woman with a kink who liked when he used canine speak? Over the past 3 years, Angel had been tied to a string of beautiful starlets. While waiting in line at the grocery store, Iris often saw pictures of him on the front cover of gossip magazines, arm in arm with another gorgeous long-legged woman. Most recently, it had been Gigi Harrison, the lead actress in several action and superhero films. Woof, woof, pretty girl, he sang. Iris couldn't help it. She laughed. Angel's head jerked up. He glanced over and caught eyes with Iris. A deep pink hue spread across his brown cheeks, and Iris backed away, embarrassed to have been caught. "I'm sorry," she said quickly. "I didn't mean to eavesdrop," although she had clearly meant to do just that. Angel blinked at her, then glanced at his phone. "Bye, girl," he whispered, waving at his phone's camera. He slipped his phone in his pants pocket. He turned to look at Iris again, leaning his shoulder against the tree. The corner of his mouth hitched up, the beginnings of a smile. "So," he said, "that's what I sound like when I talk to my dog." "Your dog?" Oh, she had been so wrong. "That makes a lot of sense." "Yeah, she has separation anxiety, so I put one of those doggy cameras in my place to check on her when I'm gone." "I see." Iris didn't know what else to say. She'd never had a pet growing up and therefore didn't understand Angel's dedication. Lately, she'd considered getting an easy pet for Calla, though, a hamster or a gerbil, maybe a goldfish. She wondered if she should properly introduce herself. Since Violet was Angel's stylist and had styled him for the SFB campaign shoot, Iris knew that Violet had told Angel that she worked for SFB. But Iris hadn't been at his photo shoot to meet him, so she didn't know if he was aware of her level of involvement in his campaign. But she had rudely listened in on his conversation just now, so she should probably give him some privacy. Also, it was the weekend. She was at her sister's wedding, and she didn't want to talk about work. Given the way that Angel disappeared from the party to FaceTime his dog, she would hazard a guess that he didn't want to talk about work either. She'd have a chance at a professional redo at some point in the future. Plus, her role was more behind the scenes. Client care was a job for Paloma and the PR team. "Again, I apologize," she said. "Please call your dog back and continue your conversation." She waved politely and set off through the vineyard back toward the venue. "Hey, wait," Angel said, jogging to catch up with her. He easily maneuvered his body, managing not to be sideswiped by an overgrown grape bush. "You're Violet's sister, right, Iris?" Now it was her turn to blink in surprise. He remembered her. She slowed her walk, angling herself toward him. "Yes, hi." "Hi." He smiled, and it was as though Iris watched the act in slow motion. His full lips lifted, then curved. His straight white teeth revealed themselves. His eyes crinkled in the corners, a picture of warmth. "Gorgeous," her brain said.
So that's the meet cute for Iris. Mm-hmm. But as you said in that reading, Angel's been watching her for like 2-3 years.
Yeah.
From the first time they met, before he blew up and was famous, and while Iris was going through something very devastating that plays a part throughout the novel. Mm-hmm. What was it about having them find each other when they were both ready that intrigued you to start their story?
You know what? That was almost an unintentional good thing that happened, because Angel is originally introduced in The Neighbor Fever as like a foil to Nick, because Lily's sisters were trying to set her up with Angel originally, and then she ends up with Nick. And I wish I could remember what I was thinking about when at the end of The Name Fever, hope this isn't a spoiler for anyone. Well, I guess not, because literally Angel and Iris are the characters in this book. But at the end of The Neighbor Fever, I was just writing this scene, you know, at the end, and they're at this party and Angel's there. I think I wanted to show that even though that's not the guy she chose or decided to pursue, they were still cool. And then I just was writing, and then Iris came up, and then he was just infatuated with her. And I was like, oh. And that is a perfect example of your character. It's just telling you something when you don't even realize it yourself. And I was just really intrigued by the differences between the two of them. You know, Angel is a little bit younger, and he is sort of a very kind of carefree, easygoing kind of person, whereas Iris is the oldest sister. She takes on a lot. She's a single mother. She lost her husband. And I felt like she needed someone who would bring that lightheartedness and ease to her life. And so because there is a time gap between The Neighbor Fever and The Love Lyric, it almost was just like, this is it. It worked in my favor that I could write that prologue. It's the same scene at the end of The Neighbor Fever that starts the prologue and The Love Lyric, but it's all from Angel's point of view instead of Lily. And you get to see him see Iris for the first time. And I also wanted to show the difference between who he was at that point, because he wasn't famous yet. He wanted to be known for his R&B music. He wanted to have a career, but he wasn't there yet. And so between then and now, when The Love Lyric starts, he's huge. He's this big superstar. And that was fun to write.
Yeah, you gave him time to grow up and achieve his dreams and mature, and you gave her time to grieve.
Yeah.
And so in putting them together where they are at these very transformational moments in their lives and allowing them to navigate that together, because of course they're going to be forced to go on tour together because Paloma is pregnant.
Yeah.
What was it that you wanted to show the audience about the importance of timing when it comes to finding the right person to love you well?
Yeah, I think for this book particularly, but also for my books across the board, what I'm always trying to say is that love is out there and you should wait for the person who will love you the way you deserve to be loved and who will respect you and accept you for who you are. That's what everybody deserves. And I think I really want that for Black women too. Like, there is somebody out there, like, don't settle. You'll meet somebody who is the right person for you in all the ways that you could want. And I think I took that even more seriously with Iris. I had this joke when I was writing the book that of all the characters I've written, I think that Iris deserves the happily ever after the most because of what she's been through. And I felt that writing the letter was so hard. It really was, because I felt that pressure. I was putting it on myself. But I felt that pressure. And also I would be hearing from readers, like, I've been waiting for Iris's book, like, since The Neighbor Favor. And, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing that there was this demand for her. But I also felt like, oh my God, if I screw this up, look, it's so bad if I screw this up. And so I had all of these different thoughts in my head, but also just in my heart, I was like, I need to make sure that this story is right for her, because I felt like that was what she deserved. And so I think that's why Angel, unlike some of the other male characters I've written, he doesn't have a lot of emotional burdens that he's working through. He has the drama with his mom and he has his complicated feelings about religion, but he's accepted them for what they are, kind of. He's like, you know, my mom stresses me out. And, you know, he, like, I just avoid her. And he's like, I don't really know how I feel about religion anymore, because he wasn't allowed to do a lot. But he's happy with what he's doing in his life. I guess his biggest issue is pushing against his record label to try to let him record the music that he wants to make. But he isn't necessarily, I think he has a lot of hope that he can do the things that he wants to do. His biggest thing in the book is just trying to get Iris. It's still like, make him halfway, you know? And so
he has a one-track mind.
He really does. And I was like, that is what she deserves. She deserves somebody who, because her mind is so many other places, he had to be the, nope, I just want you. I'm going to wait. I'm going to be whatever it is that you need. And, you know, because that's kind of the man that she needed. And when I'm writing my books, I always craft the woman first, and then I craft the man around her and what it is that she needs. And then I think, okay, what does he need from her? But it always starts with the woman first.
But even in saying that he was not as emotionally burdened, I mean, the things with his mother and his family and his religion do come up. And I think in that was one of my favorite scenes in the novel, when they're back in his hometown in the South in this very conservative, very religious environment. He's there with this woman who's trying not to be seen, but he is like desperately in love with, but like, they're not telling anybody yet.
Yeah.
And she's just like, even though she's not my man, she's like, but you're not going to talk to him any kind of way either.
Yeah.
And so they have this very tender moment, like, from was described in The Best Man, the forehead kiss, and where they're just like together.
Yeah.
Like, I love that scene so much, as I was just like, in that moment, she was what he needed.
Yeah.
And they were able to, I think, reach a level of intimacy there beyond what they were doing in the bedroom and like all the other ways that they had started to connect. It was like in that moment where they could see that they could be there for each other.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I really liked writing that scene too, where she was just like, your mom is driving me nuts. I've reached my limit.
Like, absolutely not. What we're not going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hearing back from readers from this weekend, even about the impact that your novels have had on their lives, giving them hope, whatever else, how does that buoy you as an author?
I mean, it is honestly, what I always say is, like, my favorite part of my job is the writing. Writing is hard. You know, writing is hard. I always say if I loved anything else more than I loved writing, I would do that. Like if it was easier, if I'm interested in like finance or whatever, I would do those things because writing is hard and you have no control over what happens to a book once it's out in the world. And so there's a lot of uncertainty, but it's my favorite. If I didn't love it, I wouldn't do it. And my second favorite part of my job is being able to talk to readers and meet them in person. And writing is so solitary. You're at your desk by yourself. Sometimes if you're lucky, you have writer friends who live near you and maybe you guys write together a couple times a week or you write over Zoom. But a lot of times you're by yourself and you're in your own head and you don't always know. You have big hopes for the books and what they will do. But then to hear from people who have connected with your stories, that is like everything. And I take that with me when I'm at my desk and I want to bang my head against my computer because the writing is so hard. Like, when I hear that people love the books and the writing, that gives me the energy that I need a lot of the times to keep going and to keep writing these stories. And it encourages me that people see what I'm doing and they want more of it.
So speaking of more of it, you said you have a novel coming out in October. What are you working on next?
Yes. So literally, I am in the final stages of working on the first draft of my summer 2026 book. So that'll be my next adult romance. And that's the first in a what will most likely be a duology. I see it that as two books as opposed to three books.
Congratulations. So thank I want to switch to a speed round in the game before I let you go for the afternoon.
Okay.
What is your favorite book?
No.
Top five, Christina.
Five. Okay, great. So I would say Indigo by Beverly Jenkins, 7 Days in June by Tia Williams, The Mothers by Britt Bennett, The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang, and I'll say Destiny's Surrender by Beverly Jenkins.
All right. Who was your favorite author?
Do I have another top five or is it just one?
Go ahead. Give me your Mount Rushmore.
Okay. It's literally going to be the same people. I would say Beverly Jenkins for sure. Another historical romance author named Lisa Kleypas, Helen Huang, Tia Williams. And I love Britt Bennett's books. I feel like when I read The Mothers for the first time, I was like, oh, these are the kind of literary fiction novels about Black women that I've been looking for. I've been wanting to read.
Who is your favorite artist?
Singer, you mean?
Any like medium.
Oh, I mean, I love Beyonce. I'm wearing my Beyonce t-shirt, actually. My Cowboy Carter shirt.
What do you think is the best book to movie or book to series adaptation?
Pride and Prejudice 2005 version with Keira Knightley is one of my favorite movies of all time.
If the love lyric in all of the series gets the screen treatment, who would you specifically want to play Iris and Angel?
I usually don't have very clear fan cast in my head when I'm writing, but I think Nicole Beharie would be perfect for Iris.
I see it.
She's a little bit older now, but like, I just like that would be perfect casting for me. Angel? Oh, you know, what is his name? He is in
Luke James.
No, but that's also good.
I was like, he acts and he sings, so.
He's this actor. He's been in other stuff, too. What have I seen him in? Okay, you know the Mufasa movie that came out? Not Aaron Pierre, but the other actor who played Scar, maybe? What is his name? I always forget his name. But he once played, like, he did this historical fiction movie where he played a violinist or something like that. I don't know his name.
I know who you're talking about. You know what I'm talking about? I have the movie with the violinist saved in my Hulu, but I haven't watched it yet. But now I do see the face. I have no idea what that man's name.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff. And every time I see him, I'm like, I really like him. He's really charismatic. And I feel like he has that sort of levity that Angel has. So I see him kind of, but I would gladly take Kenny Buffery. And say, like, please, it'd be nice if somebody wanted to do that. So,
all right. If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you ultimately live?
I would live in a brownstone in New York, maybe the West Village. I love that neighborhood. It's so idyllic and it's so expensive. If I could go anywhere, I really want to go to the Scottish Highlands. And it's probably because I watched a lot of Outlander. And I've always wanted to go to Scotland and literally just put on some rain boots and walk through, like, those wide open fields. I really want to do that. I don't know. And then maybe it's because I've read a lot of Scottish historical romance novels before. But I really want to go to Scotland.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Ooh, I would love to hit the New York Times bestseller list one day. I would love to learn how to swim. I don't know how to swim. When I was like 3 or 4, I almost drowned in my cousin's pool. And that gave me a very big phobia of pools and swimming for a long portion of my life. But I really love to learn how to swim. That's on my bucket list. I would also love to take a cross-country road trip.
What brings you joy?
Listening to Beyonce. seeing her in concert is just like the most singular experience. My friends, my family, reading. And I think because I'm still coming off of a high of the Black Romance Book Festival, I would say particularly the Black romance community. It was just like such an amazing experience. And I'm really glad that we all have each other. I think it's really special.
What brings you peace?
That's going to sound very Capricorn. Knowing that my deadline is met and that I have like 3 weeks where I can read for fun. And I say read for fun, so like not read for blurbs or for doing, you know, moderating events and stuff. It's I keep picturing I'm going to hand in this book and then I'm going to go to the beach and I'm going to take a book with me. I'm just going to sit for a couple hours and read in the sun and it's going to be so nice and peaceful. That's what I think about when I feel stressed. Like, oh my gosh, I have this much time left. And I think I'm just going to, when it happens, I'm going to go to the beach. And it's all going to be okay. That brings me peace.
And what is your favorite flower?
A poinsettias. And I think it's because I have a December birthday. And so my grandmother would always have poinsettias around the house at Christmas time.
Aw. So the game is called Rewriting the Classics.
Classic
is however you define it.
Okay.
Name one book you wished you would have written.
I really love Jane Eyre. But Rochester is like, you know, he's very problematic. So I respect the book for what it is. If I could rewrite it, I would make it so that he wasn't hiding his wife in the attic. That they could have like a normal love story. He's just divorced, you know, and they can, yeah.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Atonement, and I'm unfortunately going to have to spoil this for you, but part of it is a love story between this woman named Cecilia and this other guy named Robbie. Cecilia's rich. Robbie's mother worked for the family, and they sort of fell in love. And at the end of the book, they both die. It's during World War II. He dies in the war, and she dies during a flood. And if I could rewrite that, I would make it so that they stayed together and didn't die.
Yes, yeah. Because that is traumatic. Oh, my God.
It's very traumatic.
Name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught.
Oh,
and why?
When I was in high school, I did not love the Shakespeare plays that we read. The only one I liked was Hamlet. And when I got to college, I took a Shakespeare course and we were reading Othello and A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I was like, these plays are so much more interesting to me personally. So, you know, I did not enjoy Julius Caesar or Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet. I don't know what they're doing now, but at the time, I would go back and ask them to teach some things that are a little more interesting because they only taught the tragedies.
And so my final question for you today, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of work and words that you left behind?
I would like for people to say that I was very dedicated to writing stories where Black women and Black people were falling in love and they were happy, and that my books made readers feel happy and hopeful about love and life.
Big thank you to Christina Forrest for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Christina on the socials at Christina Forrest on Threads and Instagram. And make sure you check out The Love Lyric. It's out now from Berkeley. You can get a copy of the novel from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page,
It's at Black and Published, and that's B-L-K and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Christina about the impact of the inaugural Black Romance Book Festival and how it may help move Black romance novels forward. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Honoré Fanon Jeffers, author of Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Essays and Writings.
It took me a really long time, sister, to understand it. That I just thought, oh, this is individual. People are treating me this way. I just have to work harder. I have to be prettier. I have to dress better. I've got to beat my face. And I just kept working harder to be prettier, to be better, to be this, that, and the other. But then I realized this is an ancestral thing.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.